If you have your Bibles, open them with me to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 22, and in a moment, we'll begin reading in verse 36. Verse 35 through 46. Napoleon once said that every battle is won or lost in 15 minutes. In other words, he believed that in every battle, there is a pivotal 15-minute time period in which the outcome of the battle is decided. And whoever rises up in that moment will win the battle outright, and whoever falters in that moment will wind up losing the battle outright. Now, I believe that is true in the spiritual realm as well. In every battle, there is that crucial moment when you decide whether or not to believe God, when you decide whether to resist temptation or to give in to temptation, when you decide between your will and God's will, doing things your way or God's way. And what happens in that moment will oftentimes determine whether you win or lose the battle. In our passage this morning in Luke 22, Jesus and the disciples are getting ready to fight the toughest battle they have ever faced. At the end of this passage, Jesus is betrayed and he's tried and he's crucified. It all begins. But Jesus, even though he paid the price for our sin, when he died on the cross, in a sense, the battle was won right here at a place called Gethsemane. And when that pivotal moment came, we're going to notice the disciples fought one way and Jesus fought another way. And so the question then becomes for us, which example are we going to follow? How are we going to fight this battle? You know, Jesus told us in this world you have troubles. We know that spiritual warfare is a reality for every born-again child of God. And yet there are those times where there are these especially severe battles that we fight in the Christian life. Maybe for some of you, you are there right now. It is a battle for your integrity. Maybe for some of you, it's a battle for your children. Maybe for some of you, it's a battle for your home. Maybe it is your faith that's being tested or your patience that is being tried. But maybe for some of you, this is your 15 minutes. And what happens here and now will determine whether or not you win or lose this battle. And so this morning, I want to present you with two ways of going about it. First of all, we're going to see there's a worldly way to fight that brings failure. There is a worldly way to fight that brings failure. Look at verse 35. He also said to them, "When I sent you out without money bag, traveling bag, or sandals, did you lack anything?" "Not a thing," they said. Jesus is reminding the disciples of something that happened earlier in the Gospel of Luke, twice, once in Luke chapter 9 and once in Luke chapter 10. Jesus sent them out to preach. And when he did, he gave them some very interesting instructions. He said, when you go out, don't carry a purse, because yes, men in those days carried purses. He said, don't carry purse. Don't carry money with you. He said, don't even bring with you an extra change of clothes. Now, why would Jesus tell them not to carry any of these things? It's because Jesus knew how the people were going to respond. He knew that as he sent them out and as they preached, the people were going to respond positively. And those who received their message would then in turn provide for them. Therefore, the disciples would not need to carry any of these things for themselves. Now, sure, on some occasions they had to dust the sand off of their sandals, but for the most part, they were well received. And so Jesus asked them this question, but in doing so, he's also making a point. Look at that next verse, verse 36. Then he said to them, "But now, whoever has a money bag should take it, and also a traveling bag. And whoever doesn't have a sword should sell his robe and buy one." Jesus said, the last time they treated you well, but now things are going to be different. Now you're not going to get the red carpet treatment from this world. Jesus said, now they're not going to open their homes to you. They're going to open prison cells for you. Now they're not going to feed you. Now they're going to feed you to the lions. Jesus is telling them to expect a different type of treatment from this world. And sure, they had experienced opposition before, but not like this. This is something entirely different. Look at verse 37. For I tell you, what is written must be fulfilled in me. And he was counted among the outlaws. Yes, what is written about me is coming to its fulfillment. Jesus is quoting an Old Testament verse. He's quoting from Isaiah 53, which is very significant because Isaiah 53, written over seven centuries before Jesus was born, is that great passage that tells us how one day when the Messiah comes, he will suffer and die for the sins of the people. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The punishment for our peace was cast upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. This clearly describes the cross. And then in verse 12, the verse which Jesus is quoting here, it says that he will be counted among the outlaws. Now, there are two senses in which we see this happening. Jesus was physically placed between two outlaws, two lawbreakers, when he was crucified, with one on his left and one on the right, and Jesus crucified in the middle. But he was also counted as an outlaw. He was considered a lawbreaker. Even though he was without sin, he was treated as if he had sinned, as the punishment for our sin was placed upon him. Jesus said, this is what's coming. And the moment that Jesus was arrested, guess what? He became an enemy of the state. And likewise, the moment you were born again, guess what? You became an enemy of this world, and you became an enemy of the devil. And again, it changes everything. It reminds us of what Jesus said in John 15, 20. He said in the middle of that verse, he said, a slave is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If we are following Christ, we should be expected to be treated accordingly. Now listen, there's one thing a Christian should never, ever do. A Christian should never complain about how they are treated by this world. You should never complain about how you are treated by this world, because anything we get from this world better than crucifixion is all bonus for us. We're coming out ahead. Now, the disciples clearly did not understand what Jesus was saying. Look at verse 38. Lord, they said, look, here are two swords. Enough of that, he told them. A couple verses earlier, Jesus told them to expect opposition from this world, and then as a figure of speech, he said, if you don't have a sword, sell your robe and go buy one. One of the disciples responded and said, well, Jesus, we did some counting, and we count amongst us a total of two swords. We have two. Will that be enough? Well, clearly, they were taking Jesus literally. And Jesus hears that and he says, enough of that, which was kind of a nice way of saying, you guys just don't get it. Jesus was talking about spiritual warfare, but they're going back to physical warfare. And it's kind of like they are having two completely separate conversations. It's like they're talking past each other. Listen, Jesus was not condoning violence, as some people have claimed. We know that because in John 18, we see what Peter did with his sword, how as Jesus is arrested, he swung that sword, cut off the ear of the high priest's servant, Malchus. And what did Jesus do? He rebuked him. He healed the man's ear, and he said, those who live by the sword will die by the sword. And furthermore, there is not a single example anywhere in the book of Acts or in the early church of anyone fighting to defend themselves, not even in self-defense. Now, hear me carefully. The gospel did not grow by the sword. The gospel grew because of the eyewitnesses to the resurrected Christ. The gospel grew because of signs and wonders that were done through the apostles. And the gospel grew because of the testimonies of those who were being saved and who were being transformed by the gospel of Jesus Christ. Man-made religions grow by the sword, but Christianity grows by the power of the gospel. Now, some people like to get into this debate at this point about whether or not Christians should own weapons. At least two of the disciples apparently had swords. You can have that debate if you want to, but don't miss the main point. The main point is, that's not how spiritual warfare is fought. It's not fought with worldly weapons. It's fought with spiritual weapons. That's what Jesus is trying to teach them. Listen to what Paul said in 2 Corinthians 10, verse 4. Since the weapons of our warfare are not worldly, but are powerful through God for the demolition of strongholds, we demolish arguments and every high-minded thing that is raised up against the knowledge of God, taking every thought captive to obey Christ. So much we could say about that passage, but oh, don't miss this. Our weapons are not worldly. Now, what weapons does the world use? Violence. Coercion. Intimidation. Manipulation, compromise. I could go on. Those are worldly weapons, and we do not use them. What are our weapons? Faith, the Word of God, prayer, fasting, obedience, love, mercy, truth, humility, submission, praise, the gospel. And please understand, I am not being theoretical. These really are weapons that we really do use in a war that is real, but it is a spiritual war. And we have to understand that God can do infinitely more with these weapons than we can ever do with the world's weapons. Sometimes, if we're not careful, we can make the same mistake as the disciples, and we can try to fight spiritual battles using worldly weapons, and it never works. Brothers and sisters, there's a worldly way to fight, and it brings failure. But then, we're going to see in the second part of this passage, there's a heavenly way to fight that brings victory. There is a heavenly way to fight that brings victory. We've seen how the disciples chose to fight, but what about Jesus? Look at verse 39. He went out and made his way, as usual, to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples followed him. Luke tells us that Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. We know in Matthew and Mark's Gospels, even more specifically, he went to a place called Gethsemane, the Garden of Gethsemane. That word Gethsemane literally means oil press or crushing place. It was there that olives were crushed so that their oil could be given. And Jesus goes to Gethsemane because in a spiritual sense, he's going to be crushed so that from this experience, his blood can be given for us. And what we have here really is one of the most sacred scenes in all of the Bible. When we read these verses, it's as if we're walking on holy ground. I'm not sure that we will fully understand all of this on this side of heaven. But notice these two words in verse 39. It says that he went there as usual. This wasn't a one-time thing for Jesus. It wasn't a one-time thing for him to depart and get alone with his Father. In fact, this is why Judas Iscariot knew that this was the place to hand Jesus over, because he knew that it was his custom that he would go here to this garden to pray and be alone with his Father. Now, I believe that we're going to see two ways in which Jesus prevailed in the midst of this battle. He prevailed by fervent prayer. By fervent prayer. Look at verse 40. When he reached the place, he told them, "Pray that you may not enter into temptation." And then skip down to verse 45. When he got up from prayer and came to the disciples, he found them sleeping, exhausted from their grief. Now that's an interesting statement. Did you know that grief can wear you out? They were sleeping because they were exhausted from their grief. "Why are you sleeping?" he asked them. "Get up and pray, so that you won't enter into temptation." Obviously, there is a link between prayer and resisting temptation. Now, don't misunderstand this. I don't believe Jesus is saying, if you just pray enough, then you will experience a life without temptation. That's not what he's saying. In fact, James chapter 1 says, "Blessed is the man who endures temptation. For when he is tried, he will receive the crown of life the Lord has promised to those who love him." Temptation is for enduring. But no, he's saying there are some temptations that you cannot and will not resist apart from persistent, desperate, fervent prayer. And if Jesus, the Son of God, did not face temptation apart from prayer, what makes us think that we can? Yes, Jesus has been praying for them, and yet he tells them again and again, "Pray that you may not enter into temptation." They have a responsibility to pray for themselves. We know what happened, how Jesus departed. He came back, he found them asleep. I wonder how different this story would have been if they had heeded his words and spent that time praying instead of sleeping, like Jesus told them to. I wonder. Look at verse 41. Then he withdrew from them about a stone's throw, knelt down, and began to pray. Again, we know from the other accounts, even more details, how Jesus left the eight at the gate, took Peter, James, and John even further, but then left them, Luke says, a stone's throw distance, and there he began to pray. This isn't like any other prayer that Jesus ever prayed. In fact, it tells us that he knelt down. At other times, Jesus stood as he prayed. But this time, we're told that he knelt down. Even then, guess what? He didn't stay on his knees. Matthew's gospel tells us that he fell on his face and then prayed. You ever got to that point where it just felt like the pressure was so great? You couldn't stand. You couldn't kneel. You just had to get your face on the ground as you prayed. That's where Jesus is, right here. Hebrews chapter 5, verse 7 says he offers prayers and supplications with, quote, loud crying and tears. If the disciples had stayed awake, they would have heard the loud crying that he spoke of. Now, we're going to go back and look at the content of Jesus' prayer, but skip down to verse 43. Then an angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him. Being in anguish, he prayed more fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling to the ground. Notice, first of all, the creator of the angels is being strengthened by an angel. What a mystery. Now, we don't fully know in what way the angel strengthened Christ in this moment. Maybe that angel came in order to remind him in his grief of the Father's love and the Father's care for him. Maybe that angel came to remind Jesus that the Father would not abandon him, that he would not leave him in the grave. But I believe there's another possibility here. I believe that it's possible that the angel came in order to physically strengthen Jesus, that Jesus was under so much pressure in that moment that he would have literally died right there in the garden. His body would have just given out if that angel had not strengthened him in that moment. And one reason why I believe that is because of what Luke says in the very next verse. He mentions a detail here that no one else mentions, none of the other gospel writers. He said that Jesus was in anguish and prayed so fervently, sweat became like drops of blood falling to the ground. Well, people ask me, well, is this literal blood here? Luke says that it was sweat like drops of blood. Some scholars point out that that word drops means great drops. It can translate clots. You know, sweat doesn't clot. Blood clots. It's very possible that what we have here is a medical condition called hematidrosis, where a person is under so much mental and emotional strain that capillaries burst and blood and sweat are literally mingled together. Now, let me remind you, Luke was a doctor. He understood what it was he was claiming when he made this statement. But either way, you think about how fast his heart must have been beating, how high his blood pressure must have been in this moment. No wonder an angel had to come to strengthen him. And listen, I want you to understand, it wasn't fear of dying that put Jesus in this condition. It was the dread of knowing that soon he who knew no sin would become sin. It was the dread of knowing that the one who pleased his Father at every turn would soon experience the wrath of his Father upon the cross for our sin. Now, folks, Jesus didn't always pray this way. He didn't always kneel when he prayed. He didn't always get on his face when he prayed. And he certainly didn't always sweat drops of blood when he prayed. But when he came to this moment, when he came to what was the toughest battle of his earthly life and ministry, he fought that battle with fervent prayer. And there are going to be some battles in our lives that will only be won in this way, through fervent prayer. Jesus prevailed by fervent prayer, and he also prevailed by total submission. Total submission. Go back to verse 42 and notice what Jesus prayed. Father, if you are willing, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. I believe this is the most difficult prayer that Jesus ever prayed. Many times in Scripture, we see the analogy of a cup being used to describe God's judgment, as if God's judgment towards someone or some person or some people is placed in a cup. Here you have God's judgment, God's wrath against the sin of the world placed in a cup. To drink that cup symbolized experiencing it to the fullest. So that is exactly what Jesus is going to do. He said, if you are willing, take it away. Folks, Jesus knew what the Father's will was, and yet he prayed this prayer for your sake and mine so that we would understand that there was no other way, no other way for us to come to the Father, no other way for us to be saved, no other way for us to go to heaven. It's only through the cross. And if Jesus had said no, he could have avoided crucifixion. He could have avoided experiencing the Father's wrath. But Jesus decided in that moment he would rather go to hell for us than go to heaven without us. And what did he pray? Not my will, but yours be done. Make no mistake about it, folks. As someone who was fully man, Jesus had a human will, and it was not his will to die on that cross. What you have here is Jesus surrendering his will to the will of the Father. Isn't it fitting that Jesus would pray this prayer in a garden? Because it was in another garden, it was in the Garden of Eden, that Adam, facing the tree of knowledge, essentially prayed and said to God, not your will, but mine be done. Here is Jesus in another garden, the Garden of Gethsemane, facing a different tree Calvary. And he said, not my will, but yours be done. In Mark's gospel, he tells us something else about this prayer, how when Jesus prayed, he used a title. He called his father Abba, which means daddy. You know, the Jews didn't use that title when they prayed to God, but Jesus did. Paul tells us that we should as well. But Jesus used this not just as a title of endearment. He used the title Abba as he prayed to his father because he was putting himself in the position of a child submitting himself to his father. He's saying, Father, you always know what is best. Father, you always do what is right. Father, you never make a mistake. Therefore, not my will, but yours be done. Let me ask you, have you ever been at that place in your life where you were so absolutely torn between two wills, two desires, what you wanted and what God wanted? And it could be one or the other, but it couldn't be both. Those times will come. There are those times where God tunes our will to match his. But there are those times where it's going to take surrender. And guess what? Jesus has been there. He knows what it's like to beg the Father for something and hear the Father say no. And yet he submitted himself to the will of his Father because he knew that in the end it would all work together for good. Now, folks, following God's will sometimes is costly, but remember this, the benefits of total surrender always outweigh the cost, always. And so here's the question, are you willing to take all of your desires and all of your ambitions and put them on the altar of God's will? Are you willing to say no if need be? If that's what it takes to follow God's will for your life. That's the question. Now, we know how the disciples fought. They chose swords. They slept when they should have been praying. They fought the battle one way. Jesus, on the other hand, fought the battle with fervent prayer and total submission. So the question then becomes, how will you fight? And which one will it be? Because I believe every born-again child of God at some point will face their own Gethsemane. John's gospel tells us exactly how this chapter of the story ends. John 18:4 said, then Jesus, knowing everything that was about to happen, went out. Now I tell you, the moment Jesus finished that prayer and got up, at that moment, he was triumphant. At that moment, the battle was won. And aren't you glad? Because without Gethsemane, there's no Calvary. Without Calvary, there's no empty tomb. And without Calvary and the empty tomb, there's no hope for you and me. And we only have hell to look forward to. But Jesus at Gethsemane said yes to the Father's will. And he was victorious. And the victory that he won over sin and death, he offers to us so that whosoever will call upon Jesus as Lord will be saved and can share in that victory forever.